You're listening to the Utah Checkdown Podcast. And now your hosts, Josh Furlong and Josh Newman.
Welcome back to another edition of the Utah Checkdown Podcast. I am Josh Furlong, joined as always with Josh Newman. Josh, it's fall weather now. It's hoodie weather. You ready for this?
You know what? My whole life, I was a big summer guy in terms of weather. I really enjoyed summer, but I think this summer kind of broke me. Okay, there's just too many hot days, too little reprieve. 98, 100, 102. I am really enjoying the weather this week. Yesterday we got some rain. Today I took my kid to daycare, walked outside. It was like 54 and cloudy. I think I'm over summer at the age of 41.
You're ready. You're just embracing the full sweats and hoodies and.
Yes.
That's where I'm at. Like, yes. If I didn't have to leave my house, I'd probably just wear sweats all day. So I've embraced it.
That's fair.
Just shop at Costco and get my stuff. No, just all right. Well, let's get into a podcast, I guess. But first, I promised I'd tell you about how my electric car went.
And yes, let's go.
All in all, everything went okay. So there wasn't anything crazy. But caution. Anytime you rent...
Let's set this up. You have rented electric cars on the road before.
Correct.
Previously and had minimal issues, right?
Yeah, but most of the time, most of the time I've done it, it's in LA. So it's like, I'm going to be in that car for, even in their traffic. Like, I'm not sitting in that car forever. There's a million places to charge if I need to. I've never had to charge in LA just because, it's fine. But this was the first trip where, it's a 90-minute drive down to Corvallis from Portland.
Right.
That's roughly 90 miles of electricity that has to be used. And what I've learned from this trip is if you go over a certain threshold in different cars, obviously the battery drains faster. Well, this car was 55. Once you got 55, it set an alarm on you, and it beeped every time you went over that. And who goes under 55? It was fine. But the issue here is you get to Corvallis. And if you've been to Corvallis, it's a beautiful, beautiful little town. Obviously, it's a college town, and it's perfect for the college life. But there's just not a ton of stuff to do. So my plan was get to Corvallis. I got there super early. I'm going to just park my car, and we'll charge it, and then I'll kind of explore the town. The problem is there's only really like three places that are public places that aren't like at a high school or at like a junior high, which sounds really creepy to park my car there and get out. So, I park there. They tell you at the very beginning, you need a level 3 charger to charge it fast. Nowhere in Corvallis has that. It's a level 2 and lower. I plug my car in. This is at probably like 10, 11 o'clock. And it says it won't be fully charged till 4 p.m. So I'm like, okay, I'm good. Well, I walk around, I explore the town, do a little bit, get some lunch. I come back, it's not even halfway charged. Like I'm sweating now. Like am I gonna have enough charge to like get back to Portland? Anyways, I sit there. I literally sit in my car after walking and doing all this stuff for 2 hours just watching TV. Because what else am I supposed to do? There's nothing to do in Corvallis.
Right.
So word of advice, if you're traveling in a long distance and you're going to a place that has nothing to do, don't do it.
Or just, look, we're both going to the USC game. If I rent a car, I haven't really dived into that yet. I'm getting a gas-powered car.
Do it.
I'm going to pay the LA County gas prices, and I'm gonna have peace of mind, my friend. Okay, that's it.
See, LA's fine. Like, the thing is, like, if you've ever had an electric vehicle, those things have some get up. They're great. They're perfect. Mm-hmm. Even charging, I think it was like $4 to charge how much I got it to. So it wasn't the end of the world. Mm-hmm. But you're supposed to take it back to the rental place fully charged, or at least like 75%. I think I took it at 25%, because when do I have time to charge it? So I don't know.
Now maybe I'm thinking I rent an electric car in LA and we do it for content. Maybe I do that.
Welcome to the electric pod. We're gonna do that.
I love it.
All right. Well, let's go to the real stuff. See, it wasn't too bad of a PSA, but it's a good one nonetheless. So real quick, this is a Utah podcast, but let's, as we do every week, let's do a little Pac-12 rewind. Anything from this weekend that you were kind of looking at that kind of maybe stood out?
Yeah, two games certainly stood out. Of course, right, the USC-Colorado game, USC jumped all over Colorado early, and they were in control and control, and then Colorado did a nice job of fighting back and making that a game. Final score was 48-41,
yes.
I believe, USC. Mm-hmm. You know, what to make of that? Look, on one hand, you know, Colorado did a good job, again, without Travis Hunter, you know, fighting back, making that a game, making USC at least having to think about it. But I think the bigger picture takeaway there is that USC's defense still stinks.
Yeah.
Probably better than last year when they got blown up in a bunch of big games, but still not good, giving up 41 points to a Colorado team that was missing Travis Hunter and that was essentially left dead for rights at halftime. So that's something to keep in mind here. And now there's certainly this notion in our footprint here in the Pac-12 and even nationally that when you look at the top of the Pac-12, it's essentially Washington and Oregon, and that USC defense is not allowing the Trojans to be in that upper tier. Now, I contend that you still have to put USC in that number one tier just because, look, you have the reigning Heisman winner. They're capable of – look, they scored 48 points, and the idea of the game is to outscore your opponent. So I don't think you can completely discount USC in terms of, like, the bigger picture and can they win the Pac-12 and can they do something significant, because that offense is, in fairness, so prolific and so dynamic, and Caleb Williams is so good that you can't count out USC in spite of its defense. Number two game, if you want to hop on this, I mean, certainly, you know, Washington, Arizona on paper, I thought going in had some of those Pac-12 after dark vibe where maybe Arizona, again, on paper, maybe could push Washington around a little bit and at least make them nervous. Jaden Delora did not play in that game, which kind of eliminated maybe some of the after dark vibe, but you know, what were you seeing watching that game on Saturday night?
Well, before I answer that, I have to let the audience know you own the definitive rankings. So anything you say goes. Are we good with that?
Every Saturday night, if you people are not aware, okay, I go into my notes app and I update the definitive, all caps, definitive Pac-12 ranking. And my definitive Pac-12 ranking has Washington, Oregon, USC in the top tier. Definitive. All caps.
It's perfect. I mean, like, there's no disputing that. Anybody that complains against that is wrong. So, anyways, nope. Washington, Arizona. This was a game, like you said, it was Pac-12 after dark vibes. You know, it gets a little wonky in Arizona sometimes. There's some weird things that happen. But I still was kind of left wondering why Washington was that close. USC, Colorado, I wasn't necessarily as shocked. You know, Caleb Williams looked like he's, you know, can effortlessly score those 6 touchdowns, and then the defense just is terrible. But the Washington game, like, I expected them to be able to put a little bit more on them. They've been able to show that they've been able to score at will. Obviously, Arizona is a much improved team, so I don't want to take anything away from them. But I think, you know, as we've talked over the season, Washington appears to be in a class of its own. It's still in that realm with those other two teams that you mentioned, but I think Washington, for the most part, kind of felt like it was in this class of its own. But you're starting to see that when they get into tougher competition, it may be a little bit more difficult. I think you're seeing that with USC as well. Once you get difficult competition, you know, yeah, you can score points at will, but it's going to be a fight, right? And I think USC, this is the second week in a row USC has actually dropped in the AP rankings, even though they've won. They're now down to nine.
Yeah.
But like that, I mean, it's crazy. Like, you have a team like USC that should be getting all this love, and they're not, because there's other teams that are doing better. Oregon is, you know, a load. Washington is good, and, you know, they're doing their things that they need to do. So this will be an interesting race going forward. I don't think there's anything definitive outside of your rankings that we can glean from these games. But it's just interesting to look at, right? Like, I think as this conference race continues, and we're still obviously in the infancy of this, this becomes an interesting side note to how this is, right? As these games start picking up in intensity and value, you know, Oregon, Washington face off, Utah, USC face off. Like, this is going to matter. This is going to be an interesting situation. So, nothing too much from this weekend. But I will say, my one thing I will note on all this, to me, I feel like Oregon is the most complete team. I think offensively and defensively, they're probably the most complete and have the most at most ability to be able to just play a complete game. Washington still, their defense isn't as good. Better than USC at it. Excuse me. Wow. Better than USC's, I would say, but I think they're still kind of in that same situation. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. And look, we're going to start to see things get settled and we're going to see the cream rise to the top. Look, Oregon and Washington are both on a bye this week. They play each other next week in Seattle at Husky Stadium. You know, the winner of that game probably becomes, you know, on paper, certainly not the prohibitive favorite, but the early favorite to win the Pac-12, whoever wins that game. But I think just one takeaway coming out of the weekend, as you said, there wasn't anything like earth-shattering. Absolutely not. But I think you are starting to see a little bit of the haves and the have-nots separate themselves a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at the conference, who can realistically win the conference? I think Washington, Oregon, USC. You don't count out Utah just yet, right? They have one loss now, which we'll get into at Oregon State. But look, two-time defending conference champ, somebody's going to have to knock them out.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can't count them out yet. I don't know that Washington State has enough, but they've done enough where you cannot discount them yet. And of course, look, you know, they still have to play Oregon. They still have to play Washington. They'll have plenty of chances to prove themselves. But for now, I think you have to put Washington State towards the bottom of the group of teams that you think can like realistically win the conference. So, you know, again, that's just my takeaway. You're starting to see some of the haves versus the have nots and who can really, you know, get something done once you get into October and November and who can't.
Yeah. And you can throw Oregon State in that mix. Although after Friday night's game, I don't know that they're probably in that mix. I think they still have a good defense. They still got a good run attack. Quarterback play, yes, it did burn Utah at times. I don't know that they have the level of competition there that they need to be able to compete with those upper echelon teams.
Probably not.
You did see Aiden Childs in there, who I thought is actually a really promising quarterback for them.
Yes.
You know, if DJ Uiagalelei doesn't work out, I think, you know, Childs is going to be a great asset. But once again, he's young. It's the same situation with a lot of these teams that it's you know, it's difficult to get a lot of promise out of a guy in his first year. So with that, with Oregon State, let's kind of move on to kind of your biggest takeaways from that game. And there's a lot that we could touch here, and we will touch on all of it. But I think just if you're taking, you know, the 10,000, you know, feet view of this game, what is your biggest takeaway?
You know, there was a lot going on. And that's a bit of a loaded question. You know, I think the biggest takeaway was the offense is not in a good place. And, you know, you and I sort of debated here over the first few weeks of the season, like, well, can you judge the offense? Is it too early to judge the offense? And you took the stance of, well, this is what they're putting out there. Mm-hmm. You have to judge what they're putting out there. And I sort of took the stance early in the season, well, you know, your offense isn't complete, right? You don't have Cam Rising. You don't have Brand Keith. The guys are out. So I wasn't ready to judge the offense. You know, we're five games into this thing. Yeah. Yet, I'm on board with what you said early. Look, you have to judge what's out there, and this is what's out there, and it's not good from a statistical standpoint, from an execution standpoint. That was about as sloppy a game as you can get under Kyle Whittingham. You know, Kyle Whittingham teams are generally very prepared and very cerebral, and look, they're not going to put up a million yards, but they're generally like ready to play, and they just weren't. You know. You go for it on fourth down on the opening possession, didn't get that. Of course, look, Nate Johnson, we know what he does well, what he doesn't do well. We know how he has struggled. The amount of dropped passes from his wide receivers, especially early, did not help Nate Johnson's cause. Beyond that, you know, there were some accuracy issues, low balls. You know, what else? The Michael Mokafisi penalty on third and two,
that
where, you know, they ran the play and it was like, wow, like Landon King is wide open. That was either going for a large gain or maybe even a touchdown. You were at the game, obviously. I was at home in Salt Lake City watching on TV. After they announced the penalty on Mokafisi, the camera pans over to Kyle Whittingham and Kyle has this like incredulous, like, oh my God, look on his face. And that was a microcosm for the night. You know, that's the number one takeaway of a bunch of important takeaways, that the offense is just in a really bad place. And then those things are compounded by you pulled Nate Johnson and you brought in Bryson Barnes. So that is now twice in five games where your starter has been pulled. And I know that they were, you know, switching back and forth early. in the season, same series, you know, going series, but like they pulled Bryson Barnes at Baylor and it was Nate Johnson's deal. Now they've pulled Nate Johnson and it was Bryson Barnes' thing until he was injured. We don't know officially the severity of what Bryson Barnes is dealing with. He went to the hospital Friday night. I was told that he was able to be discharged and he did fly home with the team. They're on a bye this week, so we'll see what happens with the quarterback situation. Can Rising get back? Just, and I'm rambling here, but that's kind of the point. The offense is in a very bad place right now, and I don't know that just Rising's presence is going to help solve everything that's wrong.
No, I agree. I think, you know, this is the key issue for this team. I mean, you know, years ago it was special teams, you know, what's their issue? And you're nitpicking at that point, right? If you're nitpicking at special teams, you know, that probably means you're okay, and Utah was. This is a big, major problem. The fact that Utah can't move the ball, I mean, they're averaging about 25 yards per drive. That's not going to get anywhere, especially when you start at the 25-yard line. So, you know, this is a team that hasn't been able to, you know, find a rhythm. There are moments, right? Like, they have times where they can get a drive. Obviously, that first drive of the game, it's scripted, so that means they know exactly what they're going to do. They're going to come out there, and outside of not getting that fourth down that they decided to go for, I still think take the points, get the field goal, whatever it may be. I'm trying to remember where they were, so maybe it was out of field goal range. But I you know, they have the ability. The problem is there's everything that's going wrong, and it's not just one person. You can say, oh, it's Nate Johnson because he's young and he's trying to learn. And yes, Nate Johnson has some issues, and he needs to work on those. And, you know, as much as you want to see an offense that is opening up the playbook, Nate's just not there, right? They're trying to simplify it. They're trying to find ways to make him feel comfortable. We also have to remember that practice is where these guys give the coaches confidence, right? So if Nate's not doing something in practice, they're not going to put it in the game plan. It's not like they're just going to say, okay, we're going to throw it deep to money because we want to. They have to feel confident in that. There's things here with Nate where you're seeing a freshman quarterback coming in and he's not able to make the plays that Utah wants him to, right? Like, they don't have that same confidence in him. The fact is he's also not making great reads on the RPOs, right? There's some times where he's handing off the ball that the ball should never be handed off. And I'm not saying that's going to go for even bigger yardage if Nate keeps it and runs, but like, these are the things where Utah needs to get at, where they don't have a quarterback yet that they feel comfortable that can execute everything that they need to, even in just a simplistic form. Some of those plays you can even look at, you know, there's two plays back to back, and I believe it was the third quarter. Nate scrambles off to the left side. You know, he's ready. He's trying to extend the play. He's looking downfield. This is a two-part thing. The receivers don't look back at him. They don't actually help him out by coming back and giving him a target. And so he's trying to extend the play. The problem is he could have probably had 7 yards on the first run. The second run, he probably could have had 4 yards, which would be a first down. He's trying. You can see it, right? Like, he's trying to extend the plays. He's not trying to think as a, you know, a run-first guy. But, like, there has to come a point where you have to decide. And unfortunately, his decisions turn out to be the wrong ones. Then you mix that with the drops. And then you mix that with, you know, penalties. That Landon King one would have been a game changer just simply because of how big of a play it would have been. It was, what, 60 yards or so that could have been a touchdown. These things all compound on each other. So while it's easy to point fingers at, oh, the offensive line's not doing a good job, I will add, the offensive line's not doing as good of a job because teams are loading the box because Utah has no pass game. So why wouldn't you load the box, right?
Right.
But all of this is compounded together. You've got to be able to, you know, give yourself confidence. Wide receivers are going to drop passes because they're not confident, and so they're thinking about it. Quarterbacks aren't going to make the right reads because they're not confident and they're thinking about it. These things all have to compound on each other. And the best explanation of how you can visualize this is when Bryson Barnes came into the game, they didn't have to think. They got in there. They were relaxed. It was the same way when Nate got in that Baylor game. Everything changed. It was like, okay, it's a breath of fresh air, right? And so the ball moved. Yeah, they had, you know, the sack, and then Bryson eventually, you know, intercepts the ball or passes an interception. You know, this, I don't know. Like, this is a team that just is lacking an incredible amount of confidence, and so nothing is working. And so it's like, it's not easy to just sit here and say, oh, well, they need to fix this. Well, of course they need to fix this. They know that. But it's not a situation where you can just point at one specific thing, because there's so much that goes into it, and nobody is feeling confident in their ability to be able to do it.
and everything you said, you know, there it has certainly been this, you know, talk this week about, you know, the play calling and Andy Ludwig and why doesn't he have Nate Johnson do this and Nate Johnson do that. And it goes back to your point about the coaches being confident in what their guys can do. Do you people not think that Andy Ludwig like wants to give Nate Johnson more? Like, do you people really think that like
he doesn't want touchdowns? He doesn't want them.
No, he doesn't want touchdowns. He doesn't want.
Didn't he tell you that early in the season, Josh? He told you on the side. He said, "Josh, don't tell anybody, but I don't want to score touchdowns this year."
Josh, hold on to that until early October. Okay.
Okay. Like, we are in early October.
Like, you're giving Nate Johnson what you think he can handle. And you are calling in a game what you think Nate Johnson can handle. And yes, I know all about Nate Johnson's speed and the athletic ability and the elusiveness. That's great. This is not Clovis High School in Fresno, where Nate Johnson is going to run all over everybody. This is Power Five football. You can't just have him running around all over the place like you want. And yeah, the RPO stuff is a mess. They don't have a run game. They really don't have a run game to speak of.
No.
Even when Jaquindon Jackson was healthy and out there, not much of a run game to speak of. I think we've covered enough that
part of that is the loaded box, right? Like, I think part of that is that, you know, there's no passing game, so it's not relaxing that defense.
Yeah, no, that's 100%. So there are a lot of things that need to be dealt with and a lot of things that need to be fixed. You know, the number one thing that needs to be dealt with is, and this is maybe simplifying it too much, you have to get healthy. Because if you don't have the dudes out there, nothing's going to get fixed and nothing's going to be better and nothing's going to get done. So you can go on and on down the list during this bye week between, you know, Rising, Keithy, Jaquindon Jackson, you know, Samote Pepa on the other side of the ball and Connor O'Toole on the other side of the ball and Van Phil, like, and I understand, you know, Kyle's like next man up mentality, and he's right. Okay, nobody cares. Somebody's hurt, somebody's out, next man up. But a lot of your starters are out, and your starters are the ones that are going to be playing. And if your second stringers were good enough to be starters, they'd be starting, if that makes sense. Yeah. So it's not as simple as next man up, because if it were that simple, everybody would be, you know, first team caliber and everybody would be starting caliber. But that's not the way it goes. So we haven't talked to Kyle Whittingham yet this week. Okay, it's Tuesday, just before 11 a.m. We'll get Kyle later this afternoon, Tuesday. We'll see what he has to say about anything, about everything. We'll see how much he wants to stonewall us, which wouldn't be the first time, but a lot of questions and a lot of things that need to be dealt with, and too few answers right now, especially on the offensive side of the ball.
And I think that's the biggest frustration, is there's no real answers, right? Outside of Cam Rising coming back, that is their answer, right? And like, that's a worthy answer to be able to put in there. But when you've got such unknown commodities out there in terms of their ability to be able to be on the field, meaning Brant Keithy and Cam Rising, can they get on the field based on their health? That is a lot to put on them, right? Like, that's a lot to say, okay, you know, if you get back, all of a sudden our offense is going to be great. And I don't doubt that they're going to be better, right? Like, they're obviously going to be better. That gives the coaching staff a lot of confidence. There's ability there that naturally comes back with them. But there's no real easy answers to just suddenly fix it. And that's the frustration. And, you know, Kyle, you know, I asked Kyle at the post-game press conference, I said, okay, where do you go from here, right? And you know, on the onset, you would say, okay, he didn't really answer the question, but the reality is he did, because there is no real answer, and that is just, we have to stick together, we have to find a plan to work together, right? If Utah starts tearing apart each other in the terms of, like, no, you're dropping passes, and you need to make a better read, this is where things can completely turn. Now, the bye week probably comes at an incredible time for them, just simply because they now have 2 weeks to fix it. In theory, if Brant Keithy and Cam Rising, which we would expect both of them could play, or at least we've heard indications that Cal is that game. I say that knowing that we've heard indications, especially for Cam, that he could play earlier. So take that with a grain of salt. You've now got 2 weeks to be able to prepare for that. You've got an opportunity ahead of you to kind of come together as a team. The team can have, you know, player-only meetings, or you can have coach-led meetings. You can have any of these meetings to kind of come together, retool, kind of figure out what you need to do and come from there. But the point is what Kyle said, they have to stay together. They can't fight. They have to work together as a team. The problem is, can they fix it? So I don't know. This is going to be an ongoing theme, especially if Cam doesn't go. The next level there is, if Cam doesn't go against Cal, do you see him at all? And should Utah prepare for Cam at that point anymore, right? Like, should they just embrace Nate Johnson or whoever else they have at quarterback and just move on with the season? I don't think it's quite that dire. Even if Cam is ready by week 9, I still think you go with him. But we're getting to a point now where you kind of have to plan for life outside of Cam if he can't go after Cal.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this on here. I mean, my soft deadline to see Rising and Keithy is like Halloween-ish. Mm-hmm. Bye week now, and now I'm kind of at the point where, yeah, if you don't see both of them for Cal, that's when I start questioning, well, you know, do you bag it if you're those two? You know, you brought up the point about, you know, week 9, you know, hypothetically, right, like in a vacuum, like would you still, if you're Rising or if you're Keithy, would you show up week 9? I think somewhere in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, if they're not playing yet, you have to look at what kind of shape Utah is in week 9. Are they still in the mix to, you know, win the Pac-12? And if the answer is no, that's not to say that they don't want to be out there, but you have to really kind of gauge the situation and really look at what you're walking into if you're like showing up here week 8, week 9. So that might be a little bit of like what fans don't want to hear. But that is the reality. And yeah, of course, these guys want to, you know, get back and play. And of course, they, you know, they want to play with their teammates. But there's also a, you know, a long range sort of situation to think about. And I think if Joe average fan doesn't put that into consideration, I think you're being naive in terms of what the team might look like when they come back, how much of a role that plays. I'm not saying it's the biggest role, but it's absolutely part of the equation if and when you're deciding to come back. If this thing drags on towards Halloween and into November and you have a loss against USC and or Oregon, you know, with then Washington coming up, if you have 2 losses or 3 losses going into Washington, yeah, let's not be naive and let's not pretend that that's not part of the equation, what kind of shape the team is in if you're trying to decide to come back around Halloween-ish.
Yeah, then, you know, there's no real answers here, and that's the problem. And no. I think that's what's made our job difficult, is trying to talk to sources or even the coaching staff and trying to figure out what's going on, but they don't know themselves. And so it's hard to plan for this. You know, it's easy to sit here, you know, not being on the coaching staff and say, oh, they should have done it this way. It's hard, right? Injuries are difficult, especially with somebody as impactful as, let's say, Cam Rising or Brant Keithy. These things take time, and it's really difficult. Brant wants to be out there. I think Brant wants to be out there more than anybody in the world. You know, it's not like he's sitting on there to say, okay, I'm resting for NFL tape. He's got enough tape, and I understand NFL will take a chance on him. But the reality is he wants to be out there to show that he's still okay, right? He wants to be able to be there. Yeah. So, I don't know. It's an interesting situation. And, you know, sticking with the injuries, you know, on the list that I put on here for our rundown, I counted at least 12. There's more. I know there's more. But there's 12 people in there. One of them is a season-ending injury, and that's Logan Fano. He got the sack, came up, and then instantly dropped to the ground. You know, he tore his ACL. He's the one that announced that, so we haven't talked to Kyle, but Logan announced it on Twitter, so yay for Twitter. I think we all expected it to be an ACL, but you never know. That's a bummer. He's technically the number 2 guy in that room, but was playing like a number 1. That was one of those positions where the 1s and 2s probably were interchangeable. You don't see that as often. But Logan was doing a phenomenal job, was doing a great job. We mentioned Bryson Barnes went to the hospital. Assuming it's his chest area, probably broken ribs. I don't want to speculate fully. But something to that line, he got totally speared. It's an illegal play in college football. People calling for it as dirty. I don't think it was a dirty play. I don't think he intentionally did that. I just think that's a bang bang play. It happens. You know, let's cool it down just a little bit. So you've got
just
him,
a bit, guys.
Yeah, Charlie Vincent, who is a backup. It's not like Charlie is getting a ton of time, but in a running back room that is already, you know, hurt with Jaquindon Jackson out. You know, he comes up hobbling. It looks like an ankle injury. We don't know the severity. Spencer Fano, he went down for a minute with what was seemingly an ankle injury as well. He came back into the game, but Kyle mentioned in post-game that said, you know, he's still lingering with some injuries there as well. So, you know, this bye week could be very well for them. But there's a whole host of other things. Connor O'Toole was expected to dress on Saturday, but didn't. I don't know what the deal is there. We don't really know. Van Fillinger's missed time. Micah Pittman's missed time. You know, Manir McLean has been on in a boot since he played against, what was that, UCLA? Or I'm trying to remember what game. Weber State.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's just a whole bunch of stuff. And you know what? Kyle Whittingham almost added himself to the injury.
Oh, this is good.
Yeah.
Not good, but I mean, this was like a lighthearted thing. Go ahead.
So two things. I don't know if you saw this on the TV broadcast, but Kyle Whittingham on one of the plays got taken out on the sideline when the receiver caught the ball. So he was taken out. He was fine, but he got hurt there. But then post practice or post game press conference, he comes walking in and there's these makeshift chairs. I mean, some of these press conference rooms aren't great. This one's actually okay because it's Oregon State. That's a brand new stadium. But he goes to sit down, and he gets halfway in the chair, and it kind of tips over. He almost falls to the ground as he's answering a question, and just, like, I mean, this team. Like, I was sitting next to Bartle in the game, and every time a player would go down for a second, whether it was Oregon State or Utah, was just instantly like, man, what is going on? Like, this is ridiculous. Yeah. So, look, I don't know if Utah can cure the injury bug. I don't know what's going on. Are they cursed? Did some voodoo magic get done to the team? I don't really know. The reality is this is a tough situation for Utah, and they're making do. Remember, they're still 4-1. Don't get too crazy. I understand, you know, we've talked about the offense, and there's frustrations and everything that way, but everything's okay for the most part. If these injuries continue to pile up and you don't get some of these guys back, then I think it's time to worry. Am I wrong?
No. No, you're not wrong. And again, the bye probably comes at a good time just with all the guys banged up and, you know, the way Friday night's game went. So, yeah. You know, we'll see what happens this week going into next week. You know, Cal coming to town October 14th on paper. That's kind of one of those get right games where you should probably handle your business. And look, if you are reasonably healthy and you can beat Cal and you get some momentum, I think that's awesome because obviously the gauntlet is coming beyond that Cal game where you're playing USC, Oregon, and Washington inside of a month. Two of those on the road, including Washington, which could be, you know, on track for the college football playoff by then. So no game this week, but it's a critical week just to try to get healthy and try to get yourself together.
Agreed. We are at, you know, we've gone through five games of the season, week six-ish technically. So I want to do something really briefly. I want to go into midseason grades. So it doesn't have to be too crazy. Offense, what are you giving Utah in a midseason grade? Good luck.
D. that was my instinct. I mean, the offense has not been good. D might be a little harsh just because of who's been out and who hasn't been available and who hasn't played yet. But again, if we're grading this thing on who is out there, probably a D. The pass game is invisible. The rushing attack, you know, Jaquindon Jackson, he's been hurt. It just hasn't panned out the way that anybody thought. And just in regard to what Utah usually looks like in the run game, it just hasn't been good. You know, the offense is in a very bad place. C-. I'll amend my grade. C-.
See, that's kind of where I was going. I was going to be maybe generous and say a D+, C-. I think, you know, C is generally considered average, right? And this offense in general should be above average, but they're not playing that way. I think this is probably the right spot as a C-. I just don't see where you can kind of give anything better than that, even with the injuries. You know, they're getting by. We'll say they're doing enough. C's get degrees. C's get wins. we'll go with that one. So defense, I'll start with the defense. Defense, I have to go. I'm going to go A-. I'm not going to give them a perfect score. I think there are some things that can be fixed or at least focused on, and that may be the secondary in terms of the passing game. We'll see what that looks like, but there are some vulnerabilities there. It hasn't been perfect. They've had a few blown assignments. One thing that kind of keeps me, especially from giving them a full A, is, you know, they're getting the play calls a little late and they're looking really lost on the field at times. They settle in, so it's not a big issue, but there are times where Utah's defense completely looks lost and they're trying to scramble where to go. Part of that is the play calls coming in late, but you know, look, I think they're as close to an A as you can possibly get this far into the season, knowing that they usually increase and get better. So A minus for me.
Yeah, I was in that B plus A minus range. And, you know, like you said, the reason to not give the defense a full A is just because you're giving up huge chunk plays through the air. And that was even before the Oregon State game when they were 4-0. Seems like every game with the exception of Weber and really Florida. I mean, there wasn't really that much deep stuff in Florida from Graham Mertz, but you're giving up, you know, 30-yarder here, 45-yarder there. The end of the Baylor game was almost, you know, catastrophic as Baylor, you know, kind of drove down the field and hit on a couple. The defense has been really, really good, especially the front four, the front seven, and that front four specifically, that is with, you know, O'Toole out and Junior Tafuna missing time and Samote Pepa missing time. And a lot of those pieces have been interchangeable. The defense by any metric has been very, very good. So again, B plus, A minus, and that is because some of the chunk plays that they're giving up through the air.
Yeah, and that's not a bad place to be by any means. So special teams, let's go. What do you got?
Yeah, A, you know, I think Jack Baumeister has been excellent. You know, we've talked a couple of times about, you know, the special team struggles in 2021 and 2022. You know, Baumeister has improved from, you know, from last year and should probably be in the mix for the Ray Guy Award, which is, you know, we're not quite there yet, but, you know, he's had that kind of season. He's been very, very good. And look, Cole Becker is injured. But when Cole Becker is healthy and going, he's been a pretty significant upgrade in the kicking game from what Jaden Redding and I'm drawing a blank on the other kid's name.
Jordan Noyes.
Jordan Noyes, thank you. Becker is an upgrade over what those two were giving Utah. So hopefully Becker comes back soon. You know, that's a pretty significant piece of the puzzle. If you're talking about, you know, a close game in the fourth quarter, you know, Becker is a guy or has proven to be a guy early here that you can lean on if you need a kick. So yeah, you know, I'm very comfortable giving the special teams a straight A.
I was leaning on an A minus, but I think based on your conversation, I think an A is probably merited. I think, you know, you're not going to have a special teams unit that goes perfect, right? You're going to miss field goals. Nah. Sure, maybe you can get a season where that's the case, but I think this is a team that is doing far better than Utah has had in the last few years. You know, you can make some mistakes. Cole Becker obviously is injured, so you can't necessarily fault them necessarily in some of those areas. I think this is a great area. Jack Baumeister, like you mentioned, has been phenomenal for them, really flipping the field for them and giving them great field positions. So this is great. So, yeah. How about coaching staff? Do you want to go coaching staff? Do we skip that? What do you think?
No, whatever. We're here. We can go coaching staff. You first.
All right. Coaching staff.
Special teams first.
I'm going to go a B plus. And part of that, there's one hand to this where I think if Kyle can manage this, and let's say Utah gets back to the Pac-12 championship, each year we've said it's become the better coaching job because of what he's had to accomplish. This becomes probably his best job if he can accomplish this. But as it stands, I'm going to say a B plus simply because there are some things where the management of the injuries, whether that's Cam Rising and giving him reps in practice, doing things like that. There have been some mistakes. There hasn't been a lot of things. Maybe I'm being way too critical on this one, but I think B plus is probably accurate based on what's been presented on the field, especially on offense.
Yeah, I really don't have much to add. No, B plus was my instinct, and I agree. You know, I spent a lot of time late last season talking about how that was Kyle Whittingham's best coaching job because you know, you look at, you know, the injuries for that season, right? The stuff with Tavion Thomas and Keithy was out for most of the season. Cam Rising missed the Washington State game, and it was all a ton of injuries, a ton of guys banged up, and they got back to, you know, to the Pac-12 championship game anyway. And I agree. If they somehow get back to Vegas, this probably has to be considered his best coaching job. But again, really don't have much to add there. Everything you said was accurate. I would also go with a B plus for the coaching staff.
All right, so we're in agreement. So I think it's overall it's a good team. Offense can get cleared up and things can be better. still a lot ahead of them. It could either go completely off the rails with these tougher teams coming, or Utah's back in the mix. And, you know, you look at this Oregon State game as just a blip on the map of where Utah was at. So sticking with the coaching staff, though, the USA Today, they put together this coaching database that explains all of the coaching salaries. They updated it today. I'll turn it over to you. You can kind of explain what you saw.
Yeah. So as you alluded to, annually, USA Today, more specifically, Steve Berkowitz, former colleague of mine, is a data reporter in the sports department. And his job is to essentially, you know, look at the contracts, decipher contracts between, you know, football and basketball. This is all he does. He looks at contracts and deciphers them and deals with numbers. So annually, Berkowitz and USA Today put out their coaching salary database, where you're essentially getting certainly every public school and some of the privates. Not all the privates, you know, give out numbers, but Berkowitz puts together a long data sheet of what every FBS coach is making, including, you know, what the buyout is and bonuses and this whole thing. So according to the USA Today coaches salary database, which was updated this morning, Kyle Whittingham is the 23rd highest paid coach. Full pay is $6.325 million. Now that number, we'll call it $6.3 million. That includes his, you know, his base salary, mm-hmm. and bonuses and, you know, appearing on the radio and anything else. He is getting all in $6.3 million. The big takeaway from that is there was a note under Whittingham's name that he essentially was given $100,000 because the proposed, or shouldn't say proposed, it is in motion, the indoor practice facility has not they did not start building it before July 1st. And that was, you know, that's in Whittingham's latest contract, that if there is not a shovel in the ground building this thing by July 1st of this year, Whittingham gets $100,000. So that was the indication from the USA Today salary database. I think there is some context with that. Is there context with that? I had heard at one point that they were kind of maybe pushing it off a little bit in hopes of getting the NIL further along. Is that accurate?
That was my understanding, is that they wanted to kind of use some of that money more for NIL, or at least the operations around NIL to help with that.
Right.
You obviously can't have the university going fully into NIL, but they figured that they could get the boosters and the donors to be able to change that with their Crimson Collective and everything that they had right there. So that's kind of where it is. But the reality is that's in Kyle's contract. Utah's been a little reticent to want to talk about that. For whatever reason, it's kind of the taboo topic. You and I have both broached it. They don't want to get into stuff that doesn't pertain to necessarily football stuff. And, you know, that's a debate for another time. But yeah, I mean, the understanding that I've heard from people is that the NIL landscape, you know, and what Kyle wanted to do there, he felt that, I don't know that it was him necessarily, but they felt like whatever they are, that NIL was the better area to donate at the time. They still have other projects that they're working on, capital projects, that like the stadium being built. There's other things going on. So obviously donations have to come in different facets.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my understanding.
Yeah. Let me also add that, again, according to, you know, this database, Whittingham's buyout at the moment is not that he's getting fired anytime soon, but just for the record, his buyout is in the neighborhood of like 12 million plus. So he is still owed a lot of money. And whether or not you think that Kyle Whittingham might retire anytime soon, which I don't, do not underrate the amount of money that he is still owed. Money might not be the, you know, the biggest factor in his career decision making, but it's a factor nonetheless. I'll leave it there.
And Kyle is the highest paid coach in the Pac-12 in public schools. We don't know USC or Stanford. USC, Lincoln Riley is making more than him. I know it. It's easy to say. Yeah. Troy Taylor, I doubt, would be making more than him at Stanford. David Shaw reportedly got a ton of money when he was still there and was doing well. But, you know, that's kind of where it is. In the Big 12, I was interested because I wanted to see, you know, kind of where Kyle landed there. He would be the second highest rated coach there. Mike Gundy is making $7.625 million. Mike Gundy's kind of on the hot seat right now, I would think, even though he's been there for as long as Kyle has. They actually started the same year. So their 10 years are the exact same time, but things there's been a lot of speculation on Twitter that there's been some rumblings under the scene that it's not a good situation with Mike Gundy. He's had some issues with kind of some of the things that he supports in his personal life that has gotten him in trouble. I don't know that they're going to, you know, that's a hard thing to do is to fire a coach that's been there that long. But you never know, right? Like it happens. Yeah. But it's interesting. Kyle's going to come into the Big 12 as if Mike Gundy's still there, the second highest, if not, he's going to be the highest paid coach. So it's, he's in a rare situation where, you know, he's kind of untouchable. He's making a lot of money. You know, Utah supports him. This is a good situation for Utah football. I know a lot of people want to complain about salaries, but this is the competitive nature of what college football is, and you want to be able to have a coach that is paid competitively.
You know, and just based on what he has accomplished in the last 4 or 5 years alone, you know, you look at the rest of the landscape, he's probably a little underpaid.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But with that said, Utah has certainly, you know, made commitments to Kyle Whittingham. I have lost track of how many different contract extensions Mark Harlan has given him since I think his last one was four.
There's a folder somewhere in my computer that has all of them.
No doubt. I think that folder was in the computer I gave back to the Salt Lake Tribune, but that's neither here nor there.
Boo.
Everybody. No, he, you know, look, he's probably underpaid when you look at the national landscape, but he's worth every penny because he's got that program humming and really no sign of stopping anytime soon.
Hey, I still have the contract, so we're good. We got money. We're good. All right. Well, last night, Utah got another Utah got a commitment from another player, another in-state player, Davis Andrews. He's a safety from American Fork, 3-star safety, can play wide receiver as well. Really phenomenal athlete. You and I don't get into the recruiting a ton. Obviously, it's something that we have to pay attention to. The bigger named guys like an Isaac Wilson or Isaiah Garcia, who are the top 4-star guys in Utah, those, you know, we paid a little bit more attention to. But this Utah class, they've got 10 kids committed. This is expected to be a smaller class just based on the numbers that Utah has in terms of scholarships available. They can't go to the full 25 without needing to kick off a lot of other players. That's a hard balance to manage. And, you know, Kyle believes in a lot of the players that he has, so there's no need for that. But this, you know, this is great news for Utah, and mostly great news for Utah in terms that they're locking down the state of Utah. Right now they have 4 of the top 6 recruits in the state of Utah, with at least 2 of those guys penciled in as Utes. So, I mean, you're getting 6 of the top 7. There's potentially more. Steve Bartle, who is great at recruiting, if you don't follow him, you need to follow him for recruiting. That's his job day in and day out. You know, Josh and I pretend, and we don't follow them as much as Steve does, which is great because recruiting is a really tough business, and you're following kids that are making up their minds that they don't even know yet. So, I don't know. Is there any takeaways from this in terms of what Utah's been able to do this year with especially the in-state kids?
Yeah, I mean, it just keeps up the momentum, right? And that momentum has been building, you know, for quite some time between, again, Isaiah Garcia over the summer, Isaac Wilson, right, the younger brother of Zach Wilson, who obviously played for BYU. He's had a tremendous career, tremendous season for Corner Canyon. You know, some people choose to view Isaac Wilson as the future starter at Utah. Look, David Washington and now Davis Andrews and Lamar Radcliffe and on down the line. So, look, you want to be – look, Utah is not recruiting on a national level, right? They've never recruited on a national level. But, you know, you want to take care of your state, and you want to take care certainly of your region slash what you view as your recruiting stronghold, right? Parts of California up into Fresno, down into LA County, parts of Texas with Morgan Scalley, specifically Houston. They've gone into Florida a number of times. So you want to take care of what you need to take care of. And one of those important things that they need to take care of is in-state. And if there is a kid from the state of Utah that Utah wants, they need to be making sure that they are making the inroads early and getting to the finish line. And as you said here, this 2024 class is full of Utah kids that they identified early that can be future Utes. And they've done a tremendous job, again, keeping these kids in state.
And this is the hard part with recruiting is you're going to look at this and these are kids that Utah wants. There's some years where there's top talent. Like there was the QB that went to Ohio State that played at Corner Canyon, I'm blanking on his name. He wasn't somebody that they necessarily targeted as they wanted. You know, it's easy to kind of say, oh, you missed there. This is hard, right? Like, don't take ton of stock in it, but I think the most important value is in the guys that they want. If they're getting them, that's a big sign, especially now that BYU is in the Big 12, right? You're now competing with BYU at a much higher level than you've ever done. If you can keep that momentum, that's good. Now, the reality is BYU is going to get these guys. They should get some of these guys, right? But Utah's doing a good job right now of being able to keep the guys that they want as they expand into their recruiting. They're going to go more into Texas. We talked to some of the coaching staff earlier this year where they said California is always going to be a mainstay, right? They're never going to pull out of California because there's just too much talent there. But they have already started shifting some of the coaches over to Texas more. They're not putting as many coaches into California. So you're going to start seeing that this landscape change a little bit. You know, Utah's done a good job of putting a fence around Utah and keeping out some big-name players. I mean, the kid that committed last night, he was really considered a Notre Dame guy for a long time.
Right.
They got him. Utah's gotten some guys over USC, Washington. There's some other guys that, you know, there's some good names out there that Utah's winning these battles with. So it's important for the state of Utah, for Utah. They need to be able to have that. Don't get too much into it, right? It's recruiting. Until these guys put their pen on paper, even then, they can transfer. So, I mean, this is just something to get excited about as a fan base just because it's new guys, new blood. But, yeah, I don't know. That's why I don't get too much into recruiting, honestly.
No. And the Ohio State kid that neither of us could name, Devin Brown.
I knew it was Devin. I couldn't remember his last name for some reason.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, even before I was here, I dabbled in recruiting specifically on the basketball side. It just wasn't for me. Like, I don't really want to chase around like a 17-year-old kid, but like, if you do it, you know, the way Steve Bartle does it, Bartle does a really good job with the recruiting stuff and building relationships and being the guy in this market for recruiting. There's nobody doing this better, you know, than Bartle. So if you're somehow a Utah fan and not following Steve Bartle for recruiting, you need to get on that.
Yeah, this is our pitch for Bartle. Go follow him. He's great. Also a great dude. We love him. So. All right. Well, I think that's probably pretty much it for the bye week. Anything else that you wanted to talk about with the bye week? I'm just ready. I'm happy to have a bye week. That's all I have to say.
A couple things. I mean, I don't want to get too much in the weeds here. Really don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but I did think it was interesting from a media standpoint that there was no Monday press conference during the bye. That's usually, as long as I've been here and it has not been COVID, that's been SOP, having Kyle do his regular Monday thing during the bye week. So there was no press conference yesterday, which that didn't set any bells off per se, but I definitely been thinking about that and kind of that strategy. So what's going to happen here is, again, today's Tuesday. We're at 11:25 a.m. We're going to get Kyle after practice, not in a traditional press conference setting, in more of a scrum setting, which is a little more chaotic than a press conference setting. Again, not going to get too far in the weeds here. I'm curious to see what happens in that scrum setting after practice. Again, journalism brain goes off. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but we'll see what happens. And then we're on a tremendous run of day games for Utah.
Yes.
The Cal game was announced on Monday. Let's go. The Cal game was announced as a 1 o'clock?
Yep. Pac-12 networks.
1 o'clock Mountain Time kickoff. I know that doesn't please a lot of people who, you know, have kids in sports or have kids in activities during the day on Saturday. I think a lot of parents would prefer night games when, you know, children's activities are not going on. I don't speak for you, but I know that you feel the same way. From a media standpoint, as somebody with kids, right, we both have kids, I think we do prefer day games and get it done and not be in the press box until 1-2 in the morning. So I'm sorry for everybody that has a schedule problem, but I wish every game were at like dawn. Yeah. Quite honestly.
Yeah. No, see, this is where I'm like, I can see both sides of the coin, right? Like, I love the day game simply because it allows me to do what I need to. And as an AP voter, I have to put my ballots in that night, and I'm writing my story for the next day. So I'm trying to get everything set. If Utah has a late game, I'm finishing my stories at 2 o'clock in the morning, getting home, you know, doing my AP stuff, because it's not easy to do it all throughout the day. You have to wait till it all ends. I'm finishing that stuff at 3 or 4 in the morning. Not easy to sleep in when you have kids. Right. But then on the same side, on Saturdays, you know, my kids, they play baseball and competitive baseball, and they're traveling in different areas. So, for example, I flew home from, let's see, where was I last week? Corvallis, Portland. There we go. I couldn't even remember where I was at. I flew home, immediately got to the airport, drove to Logan so I could watch my son play baseball. Like, I get it. It's a tough situation, and it's not easy. But as somebody that has to write about these games and stay out late, I would prefer to have them day, you know, even if it's 5 o'clock, I'm okay, because that's like you can still get the night environment. Most of the day has been done. It's six games in a season. Like, and I get that this is a peak time for football and basketball and soccer and all that. But look, it's six games. If you really want to get there, watch it. That's my take. But
now, and look, again, like I'm like half kidding when I joke about this on Twitter. I am empathetic. Look, I have a kid now too. Like, but a night game, like, I miss dinner time. I miss bedtime. I really like doing both of those things. So, you know, good, bad. I will say, and this has kind of been like an ongoing joke, like, do not like email Mark Harlan about game time. Like, the athletic director at Utah, the athletic director, they don't have any say in this. It's all the TV networks. And, you know, the TV networks don't care if your kid has baseball. The TV networks don't care if I like putting my kid to bed. They're going to do what they want to do. And again, I don't speak for you, but I'm going to keep goofing on it, good, bad, or otherwise.
Okay. Same. I'll still take the heat on Twitter. I'm fine with it. It's okay. We'll live.
Love it.
All right. Well, it's a bye week. We got nothing more, but we've got a special guest coming up Thursday. We won't say anything who that is yet, but special guest Thursday. Tune into that. It'll be a little different than football. I'll say that. How about that? But we appreciate you guys listening to us each week. Continue to hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, wherever you do. I don't get on Facebook, so don't hit me up on Facebook.
No, don't do that either for
don't
me.
Do that. But hit us up on Twitter. The tweet machine is where it's at, and we'll be happy to chat with you. But thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you again next time.
Thanks, guys.